So, good morning, and good day, and all the other goods that there be. Just went through our a nation's conflicted celebration about its birth, and so those of us who are here apparently survived that. We're here to meditate, and more important, to support our recovery. And so I will guide a meditation. So let's start with that. I'll sit for about 20 minutes, and I'll talk for part of that time. So just settling into a supportive meditation posture. It can be sitting or lying down, or even slowly walking. You can close your eyes, or if you're more comfortable, leave your eyes open. There's really no need to look at the screen. It's an opportunity to just listen. And so, to begin with, just a general sense of feeling yourself sitting and feeling whatever sensations are in the body. I was just talking about how often when we begin a meditation, it can seem like we're not really ready, or that there's too much going on in our mind, or that we're too restless. And so the beginning of practice can just be a time of opening and really just accepting whatever energies are present in the body, in the mind, emotionally. And that acceptance itself is really the beginning of practice. It's a shift from the ordinary way of being, of reacting, to one of observing, allowing, being with. And can you notice that you are breathing, even as you are feeling your body? What is your breathing like right now? Is it deep or shallow? Smooth or rough? Oh, allowing the body to settle, to relax, softening the belly, releasing the shoulders, relaxing the jaw, and what other whatever other areas of the body recall to you for attention, for settling. When we're particularly distracted and agitated, it can be difficult to even tune into the body. It can almost seem as if it's far away or behind a veil. That's just something to be aware of as well. We don't have to fix that or change it, just to, again, just see what is your experience right now. It's not helpful to have a model for the way things should be. It's not what we're doing here. We really want to just see what is. And that might be a little unpleasant and not particularly enjoyable, but it's okay. You can be with it. And keep breathing. Keep at least a modicum of awareness on the breath. And gradually you may be able to bring more awareness to the breath. Feel the distinction between an in-breath and an out-breath. What's the difference in terms of sensation? This practice can feel almost too simple. Might be asking yourself, isn't there more to it? But as a really foundation, you don't want to complicate it, but keep it simple. Certainly, the 12-step language of more will be revealed applies. But more is revealed really as the mind settles. And that settling takes some time, takes some patience. or when you notice your mind has wandered, to gently bring it back to the breath. If there's a persistent feeling or agitated thought pattern, turn the attention to the feeling and see if you can breathe with that. That means that you feel the breath and you feel the feeling together. This again takes an openness and acceptance. There's a strong tendency to avoid putting attention on unpleasant experiences. So we have to train ourselves to do that. It takes a softening. It takes a certain courage. The power of this practice is the power of the attention, the transformative power of attention. When we bring a gentle, kind attention to the difficult, to the unpleasant, it has a transforming effect on the unpleasant experience. This isn't a magical or automatic fix, but we do see with patience that this changes how we experience those difficult moments. All right. So again, welcome. I've been working with my book, A Burning Desire, which is about using the Dharma as a higher power in the 12-step work. And I'm going to read some of it this morning. I haven't actually been reading a lot of this book to you. But I was looking this over this morning. It seems worth reading a little bit. This section is on right view. It's on page 76, if you happen to be reading along. Right view sees the truth and inspires us to follow the path. It connects suffering and its cause, showing us the root of our problem. It sees that actions bring results, thus inspiring us to live wholesomely, guided by spiritual principles. When perfected, right view is synonymous with enlightenment. Right view is, in the listed formulation of the path, the first step. Having right view means that we understand the Four Noble Truths. It means that when we hear the Dharma, we say, "That sounds right," rather than, "I disagree," or, "Huh?" The power of right view guides us and inspires us to step onto the path. It energizes us to take on the arduous work of spiritual development. Without this vision, we are blind to the truth of suffering and to the way out of suffering. Without this power, we continue to react to the world in ways that lead to more suffering. It's not easy to overcome a lifetime's, or perhaps many lifetimes, conditioning, to go against our own culture and to take on the work of uprooting the hatred, greed, fear, and confusion that are so deeply embedded in us. To begin this work, a powerful vision of the futility of chasing pleasure must enter our hearts, together with the possibility of another way. In the same way, it is the insight into the suffering and pointlessness of our addiction that inspires our recovery. Right view is this vision, an awakening to the fundamentally unsatisfactory nature of life as it's commonly lived, and a realization that letting go rather than accumulating is where freedom lies. This vision is the starting point of the path, the spark that ignites our commitment to seek another way, and it is the moment of clarity that brings us to step one's admission of powerlessness. I was going to read more, but that kind of feels conclusive in a certain way. I mean, it's interesting, you know, it kind of introduces, you know, in the background, steps one and two, at least, a powerful vision of the futility of chasing pleasure must enter our hearts, you know, and that's, you know, step one, kind of seeing that we're powerless and that our addiction is you know, going nowhere, right? Together with the possibility of another way, which is step two. I'll read some more because I don't have something I want to jump into right away. I was living through a cold Vermont winter when I first encountered a book on Buddhism, Chögyam Trungpa's Meditation in Action. I'd just learned transcendental meditation and was meditating religiously twice a day. Crazy things were happening in the outside world. A mayor and city supervisor assassinated in San Francisco and 900 people poisoned by their cult leader in South America. But my world was the cocoon of a magical Afro rock band, music that had helped to inspire me to begin a spiritual journey. My walk-up studio apartment was on the third floor of a building on the main street of Burlington, a block away from the club that our band played regularly. The old building had 10-foot ceilings and rattling radiators, and my place was barely furnished. I sat on the bed and worked my way through this short book with wide eyes. Something I'd looked for all my life had finally arrived, a way of seeing the world that made sense. A little chime went off in my heart with an arrow pointing this way. It was the beginning of right view for me. To have right view about the Dharma isn't enough, though. When I read that book, I connected with the teachings and felt that I understood what they were talking about. What I didn't see was how my own way of living was so out of touch with right view. While I saw the first noble truth, the truth of suffering in my life, I didn't see how my addiction was causing that, and I didn't see how so much of my approach to life was unrealistic. While the Eightfold Path made perfect sense to me, I really only engaged in the meditative aspects of it, and even those in a limited way. I never embraced the bringing the Buddhist teachings into every aspect of my life. In other words, I didn't take the precepts is really what I'm implying here. For the 7 years between first learning about Buddhism and getting sober, an inner struggle took place between my increasingly wise view and my addictive, confused view. My spiritual hunger fought with the deeply conditioned impulse to act on my craving. Against the background of my personal history, my family and genetic history, and the culture of drugs and alcohol I lived in with my music career, the eventual triumph of right view over addiction is an indication of the power of the Dharma. When I got sober, even though for a few years I was less engaged in Buddhism, right view actually grew in me. Seeing the truth of my addiction was, of course, a vital breakthrough. Dealing with the basics of life, work, money, relationships, and living ethically and responsibly deepened my understanding of how karma works, and I had an increasing clarity of view. This refining of understanding goes on to this day. The layers of conditioned craving and ignorance continue to resist growth, even as I work to strip them away. Right view is not just something we have or don't have. It can be cultivated. Practicing mindfulness, engaging life with openness and curiosity, being willing to challenge our beliefs and assumptions, all deepen our understanding of right view. That's how we tap into its power. The higher or more in tune our view gets, the more clearly we see the truth and the more wise we become. As we develop the rest of the path, view is developed as well. The culmination of right view is enlightenment, the highest view. In this way, right view is seen as both the beginning and the end of the path. And then I have this little prayer. I commit my heart and mind to the search for truth, for seeing the Dharma in all things. May I be free from ignorance. That's definitely an interesting take. So well, first I'll just sort of address this language of right, because it's sort of, we could say there is wrong view, you know, which is sort of like the opposite of this, you know, the belief that you can find happiness through accumulating material things or by pursuing sensual pleasure would be wrong view. But there's lots of aspects of wrong view. All you have to do is pick up the newspaper and you'll see pretty much all the manifestations of wrong view, greed, hatred, and delusion, for instance. But I guess the thing that I'm sort of like concerned about when I hear this term is, when I hear the term right view, is, oh, are people going to feel like, oh, wait, do I have right view or do I not have right view? It's not sort of something that you have or don't have. It's something that arises in the moment, right? And so we can be, you know, strolling along in wrong view and then wake up and realize, oh, wait, well, that's not right, and get clarity. And I think that's a common thing for anybody on a spiritual path. I was going to say for anybody, but I think some people are actually just stuck in wrong view. So that, but when you've got this sort of intention to live according to spiritual principles, as people who work the 12 steps and, you know, are really on a intentional path of recovery are, you know, so if you're trying to live in accordance with spiritual principles, then at least some of the time you're going to realize, oh, this is how I should view this situation, you know. And then, because we're human, a certain amount of the time we're going to forget, right? And so this is another reason I was talking before we started the recording about daily meditation. It's another reason to meditate daily, because it really helps to kind of clear away the fog of our view that comes and goes, that kind of builds up. I mean, I'm amazed by sometimes about how easily I can fall into just sort of my habitual negative patterns if I don't really maintain my spiritual condition, as the big book says. And you know, and for me, this group is a big part of maintaining that spiritual condition. You know, being with you and talking about the Dharma a couple times a week gets me, tunes me up, you know. And, you know, and when people want to talk and get guidance and I take time to talk with people and counsel people, again, it kind of sharpens my view. Because so much of life is, you know, is pushing us in the other direction. You know, certainly you guys are familiar with my, how disturbed I get about the world, you know, and politics and all of that. And you know, there's a line in there between, you know, looking at the world and with right view and paying attention and caring about it and bringing compassion and wisdom to it. And that, where I'm maintaining some balance and right view, and then crossing the line over into frustration and anger and despair, or where it's really not right view. Which is, you know, it's interesting to say that despair, there's something there. I don't have it right now, but how that relates to right view or wrong view, you know, that I guess what's there is the sense of, you know, something permanent. And when we despair, it's the sense that, well, things are just bad forever, or they're just going in a bad way and they're going to keep going in a bad way. You know, impermanence, which is a key element of right view, is so hard to remember and to see that we have to keep this big, big picture about the world. And, you know, in Living Kindness, you know, I have that chapter called The Greed, Hatred, and Delusion Report. And it's about seeing the news through this lens of right view, of seeing that what's manifesting in the world is greed, hatred, and delusion. And, you know, that's not like something that cheers me up. But it's a way of working towards equanimity, right? Because we have to find a way to hold the world's suffering. I didn't mean to go there, but so in terms of our daily practice, you know, when we tend to have right view when we are in an equanimous state, right? When our mind is at ease, when our heart is at ease, it's much easier to see things with clarity. And so there, you know, we don't just sort of force ourselves into right view. I mean, we can intentionally remind ourselves of the truth, and, you know, that don't take this personally. Everything is impermanence. Clinging causes suffering. You know, hatred causes suffering. But in order to feel that, and therefore kind of walk through and move through our life with a kind of this clarity, we have to also calm our hearts, you know, and take care of our hearts. And this is where our practice comes in, you know. You know, meditating doesn't automatically give you right view, but if you understand the Dharma and you practice meditation, you're much more likely to remember in a given moment the wise response to circumstances, and you're less likely to be caught up in those reactive patterns that take us away from that kind of clarity. So it's kind of a theme for today is to maintain our practice. And I guess I say it to you partly because I'm leaving you. it's what the Buddha said when he was leaving for good, you know. But I'm also saying it for myself, because I also know that because I'm not going to have you guys to keep me honest over the next few weeks, I have to really work at my own practice on my own. And actually, I've discovered that vacations are it's hard to find time to meditate on vacations. It's an irony and a paradox, because one would think, oh, you've got plenty of time. But the way my practice works, and probably many people relate to this, it fits into a routine. And that's what makes it easy. It's like when I get up in the morning, shower, meditate, eat breakfast, go on with the day. If I get up and there's a bunch of people and there's activities, plans, and then all of a sudden, oh, there's no routine. And so I have to really make a little bit of extra effort to practice while I'm away from you and keep right view, you know. there's nothing quite like that talent for spoiling a good vacation, you know. it's like one of those, we have these projections about what's supposed to happen and how great it's supposed to be, and then there's all the, and reality intervenes. You know, it occurred to me some years ago, maybe decades ago, that there was a distinct difference between things that I imagined and the actual doing of those things. The main difference being that when I'm imagining them, my body isn't involved. And when my body is there in that place, then all of a sudden that reality, you know, changes. And there's that, you know, that potential for dukkha. You know, when I'm creating it in my mind, it's all the edges have been sanded off, and there's no hunger, there's no sleepiness, there's no irritation, there's just the image of the beach and the sun and the water. Although this, it's not, I'm not going somewhere where there's going to be any sun. There will be water, mostly falling from the sky. But so now I'm just rambling. So I apologize. So I guess I'll just open it up for you guys. See if there's any thoughts or comments from people today. So thank you for listening. Hi, Julie.
Good morning, Sangha. And I will certainly miss you, Kevin. I think I've said that before, and I wish you bon voyage, bien viaje. I loved the meditation. I loved your offering, so thank you. I heard, because I tend to be, you know, word focused, I heard you contrast right view with wrong view. And it has been offered, I've heard actually a few teachers mention that it's not necessarily right versus wrong. It's more right, meaning wise. So right view, it's not, the contrast wouldn't be wrong view, but it's right view in terms of what is wise, helpful, wholesome, beneficial, versus less skillful and wise and wholesome and beneficial. So it stood out in stark contrast from what I think of as right view. So I just wanted to, it's not a matter of right or wrong. It's just a matter of the way that I've been framing it. And I heard it different today.
Yeah, fair enough, Julie. Thank you for bringing that up. The section right before, or what I read from Burning Desire, talks about this a bit and says that, quotes Ajahn Amaro saying that the word Sama, which is we translate as right, is related to kind of a musical term for being in tune, which I really like as well, kind of being in tune with the view. I guess maybe it's just my mood or my current kind of, you know, you kind of go through different phases in terms of how you think about things, because I've kind of avoided that at times with the right wrong dichotomy, but right now to use right in another way, I'm kind of feeling that dichotomy, and I think partly it is because of the horrors of the world right now that are clearly, you know, in my view, wrong view, you know. And so as much as I generally agree with that philosophy that we shouldn't really set them up as these conflicting ideas, at times my frustration kind of just is like, no, it's wrong view, you know. So there's that. It's just different sort of mind states in a way that I think, you know, the point is well taken that what we want to do with this language is find the language that works for us, and not get stuck in a particular view of how the language should be used, because as I was saying earlier, I don't want to plant an idea in people's minds that, oh, have I got right view? Have I got wrong view? It's the, you know, fundamentally, it's not a solid thing, right? It's not like, oh, I got right view, never going to lose it again, you know, or I've just got wrong view, I can never get right view. No, that's, as I was sort of describing, it's something that kind of comes and goes with different mind states. Thank you for bringing that up and just bringing that into the conversation. Perfect. Yeah. You know, on that topic, this group in Ireland that just invited me to speak, they're Free Thinking Recovery. They're called Free Thinking Recovery. In Free Thinking Recovery, you are free to have your own beliefs, but we do not emphasize any particular view. So there you go. Ted, hello.
Greetings. Thanks.
Yeah.
I was at first thinking about the right view also, and I don't want to sort of drag that through the mud, but what the person was saying earlier rang true for me as well. And it seems as though I and in my culture here in the States have so easily see it as black and white and right and wrong. And I want to compartmentalize everything, you know. So I'm glad to hear your take on that. I followed some Jodo Shinshu Buddhism in Japan, and the temple is Shokenji, which I guess translates to right view. Huh. And I was confused by that at first, and I thought it was right and wrong. And I think they meant it as more clear mm-hmm. view mm-hmm. and authentic. Just wanted to say that was neat when you're reading about being willing to challenge our beliefs and our assumptions. And that to me sounded like kind of an acknowledgement of letting go of attachment, maybe of sort of fixed ideas.
Yeah.
Would that be the case?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to bring up, because when we think about what we cling to, you know, in particular, obviously in addictions, you know, it's usually clinging to a substance or to relationships or to some behavior, but clinging to views and opinions is one of the most, I'm not sure crippling is what the right word, but certainly one of the things that really limits our potential development of wisdom and traps us. As I'm saying that, I'm thinking about how attached I am to my views and opinions, but there you go. But it's one of the, when they describe these stages of enlightenment, like letting go of views and opinions, and that is one of the critical stages. And in the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on loving kindness, right near the end, it says, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires. Anyway, there's something about views and opinions, lost it. That's really hard, because those are the things that sort of how we define the world, you know, through those views. And, you know, there are certainly, this is one of the things that I try to bring as contemplation to political questions, because that's one of the areas where views and opinions are so strong. And, you know, and one of the really great practices is to try to really understand what other people think when they think opposite to what you think, and to get inside their mind and understand what their view or what their opinion is based in and what drives them. And what becomes clear is that how grounded in like emotions those things are very often, you know, an identity, sense of self. And that becomes, that's why it can be really difficult to change people's opinion about something, because their identity is wrapped up in it so much. You know, it's like, it'd be really hard for me to become a Red Sox fan. I mean, it just would be really hard. Like, just like my identity is not that, you know. They're great, love, respect them tremendously, but just would be really tough. That's just a safe example, you know. But one more, Jasmine. Oh, well, Mike's got his hand up too.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi. Hello from the UK. yeah, it's just, it's not, who am I to know what's right, really? And we have a kind of phrase in AA in the UK, which is, you know, when I get out of the way, things, when I get out of the way, things arise, really. And it's kind of what's been talked about already, that kind of challenging beliefs and assumptions. For me, it's the step seven prayer, you know. And it's over to my higher power or whatever that might be, to see how I can be useful. And that kind of happens in every moment, really. So everything I interact with, everything and every person I interact with, if I'm willing to put myself aside and actually listen and see, then lots of teachings happen.
Yeah. Lovely. Thank you. Location reminded me to put the link into my day-long event in London. So I put that in the chat in case
you're
interested. July 30th. Breaking the spell, disenchantment, and the end of craving. So it's going to be live. It's not going to be online. So.
Oh, great.
Yep. Mike.
Yeah. Hi, Kevin.
Hi,
everybody. Something you said about how right view arises in the moment kind of brought up some other thoughts. I think maybe I'd heard from you or other people about right view. I mean, we have kind of the theoretical knowledge, and you talked about it, of, you know, impermanence and karma and not self and dukkha, but, you know, taking the insight from that and applying it to ourselves and the situation we're in the right moment. And I just kind of wanted to mention that and kind of see what you thought about trying to apply it in the moment to our own kind of selves and our own situation.
So this is why mindfulness is so important, because, you know, mindfulness is part of the Eightfold Path, but it's really it's like the required element to activate the other seven elements. So in order to have right view in the present moment, you need to be mindful. And that's because mindfulness is inherently right view, you know, but it also helps us in that moment to have clarity. Because when we don't have mindfulness, then we are operating just on conditioned reactivity, the habitual ways of acting and reacting to things, and habitual ways of seeing things. So with mindfulness, we can stop and go, okay, is this way that I'm reacting right now, this anger or this fear or this judgment or this defensiveness, whatever is coming up, is this appropriate? Is it necessary? Is it right? You know, is it helpful? Is this just a reaction, or is it, you know, is it wisdom? And that question itself gives, you know, opens the door to the possibility of having right view or having attuned view. And without that, yeah, it's just all theoretical, you know. Then, you know, it's easy enough to just like grab some Dharma thing and say, oh, this here, but not really connect with it. And that can be, you know, everything from a sort of spiritual bypass where we're avoiding actually feeling or experiencing something to a real distortion, you know. Oh, well, everything is just empty, you know. Well, there's no self anyway. It's like, well, that's, you know, technically speaking, that's right view, but if it's coming from, you know, an aversion or a judgment, you know, then it's not, right? So that's why you have to be mindful, because it's not just an idea. Right view isn't just an idea, you know. It has to be applied skillfully in the present moment to the present moment situation. You know, and this is what's challenging about being a Dharma practitioner. There isn't this formula like with fundamentalism where it's like there's a right and there's a wrong. Thank you, Julie, for bringing that up. You know, that's not the point. The point is, in any moment we have to respond skillfully, and that takes clarity, and that means mindfulness. And that mindfulness is guided by certain principles, right? Spiritual principles. And those are grounded in the Dharma. They're also grounded to me in the 12 steps, because there are aspects of the 12-step recovery and just general recovery that can be missed in Dharma circles, you know, when we don't really understand. I think that people in recovery understand certain aspects of the Dharma in a way that the typical practitioner doesn't. And that's because we've really seen the truth of suffering, the truth of clinging, and the truth of letting go. So I think I answered your question.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. And have a great trip.
We may have to go back and review the tape to see whether I answered the question or not. So we don't have instant replay on here. So, but if you're watching this on YouTube, you can try that. So, yeah. So in my, before I go, just to say, you know, one more time, I encourage you all to continue your daily practice and keep coming to this group. There will be wonderful teachers, two of whom are here today, Anne and Debbie. And Walt will also be dropping in sometimes. So the same times there will be this group. And as usual, the second Friday, which is this coming Friday, will be the Spirit Rock group. at 7:15, and Walt Opie will be leading that. So yeah, keep asking yourself what is skillful. You know, in this moment, what's a wise response to this moment? That is our mantra, you know, as Buddhists. We don't have a mantra where we say the same thing over and over. We just try to respond skillfully in the moment. So blessings, and I'll see you all in a few weeks.